else would they have done? It was 1923. No one had invented the parking meter. Carl McGee didn't do that until 1935. No one had invented the residential permit parking district, right? I think the first time the Supreme Court upheld Arlington, Virginia's parking ordinance and their residential permit parking ordinance in 1977, I think it was. And then they spread really rapidly through the country. But basically in 1923, there were no other ideas. So we go along. Thankfully, it wasn't until 1939 that Fresno, California decided that minimum parking requirements should be adopted for other land uses besides residential ones. And then right after World War II, almost every city in the country suddenly said, let's have minimum parking requirements. And we undertook this radical 60-year experiment on our cities. So what was the purpose? Well, minimum parking requirements, they were adopted, well, if you pick up the zoning code of Pasadena, California, it tells you that the purpose of minimum parking requirements is to alleviate traffic congestion. And in San Diego, the zoning code says the purpose is to alleviate traffic congestion and reduce air pollution. And so the question is, has it worked? Right? Is the problem in Los Angeles that we could solve air pollution if we just had more parking lots? Right? And frankly, as far as traffic congestion goes, every single city in California just about has minimum parking requirements. And yet traffic congestion has not only gotten worse, it's scheduled to triple. And there was a guy named Holly Simpson. Holly Simpson was the first president of the Institute of Traffic Engineers, as it was called then. And back in the 30s, he said, you know, free storage for automobiles is an economic fallacy. Thankfully, he actually had a little sense of economics, which was missing from most of the traffic engineers. If you think about the conventional paradigm for parking, traffic engineers will often say that, oh, traffic is like water. You know, if you bottle it up in one place, it'll flow to another. And so the metaphor is that cars are like drops of rain falling from the heavens. You know, they're kind of inevitable. And then they land on the streets, and they pour down these basically automobile storm sewers. And then you need to construct at every destination a detention basin big enough to store as many cars as show up magically. And so you often get, say, a typical office park has 2.56 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet of office space. I'm sorry, 2.56 spaces occupied, you know, cars that show up, 30,000 square feet. And you look about 22 studies, and that's the average. And these are places with ample free parking, no transit, no alternative, right? So the typical city planner and engineer says, well, let's set it at 4 per 1,000 as the minimum requirement for that number of spaces per 1,000 square feet, because that way we're essentially planning for the 100-year parking event. 35% of the parking at the average auto-oriented office park will never ever be used, but we've planned for that 1 out of 10 office parks that really do need 4 per 1,000 when parking is free. Okay, so at this rate, what you get is a landscape of parking lots at so many destinations. And from the urbanists, of course, if you're trying to build compact, walkable places, I think we come to the conclusion that we need to rethink. That maybe the first instinct in 1923 wasn't the best solution. Personally, I was trained as an economist. So I tend to think of traffic not as being like water, where cars fall like raindrops, but as human beings making decisions. And they're influenced by a number of factors, such as the price of the parking, the price of the transit, a number of other things. So if we think about, I wrote down a 7-step recovery process, which should be easier than a 12-step, I hope. But the first step is to charge the right price for parking. Everything I'm saying today, pretty much, the latest version is in a study that we put together called the Pasadena Traffic Reduction Strategy Study. And so if you type the phrase Pasadena Traffic Reduction Strategy Study into a search engine, a copy of the study will pop up. You can also just put in my name and the word parking, and that will turn up a number of PowerPoints. So charging the right price for curb parking is the first essential step in recovering. And what's the right price for curb parking? Well, Professor Donchuk will tell you that the best price is the price that leaves about one or two vacant parking spaces on every block. So it can vary by time of day or day of week. But he says, even if you have more than that, if you have a price that's higher than that and all the customers go away, then you're charging too much. And if you lower the price below that rate, so that every single space on the block is full, you're charging too little. It's essentially the Goldilocks theory of parking prices, right? Not too hot, not too cold. Rates are too high, everybody goes to the suburban shopping mall. Rates are too low, well, you can't attract more customers by making it cheaper than the price that's needed to keep the space empty. You know, once the spaces on the block are full, you can't get more customers by making it cheaper. It's a fixed supply. Okay, so once you do that, well, actually, let me describe how to do that. If you charge the right price, then the problem is that in Pasadena, for example, they change their parking rates about once every 14 years. In order to do this, what cities like Redwood City and parts of Seattle have done is they say the goal for staff shall be that they shall adjust prices to maintain about an 85% occupancy rate for the curb parking, about one out of every eight spaces free. And then staff is authorized to go ahead and adjust prices, raise them up or down, to meet that goal. Now the question is, how do you possibly make this politically popular? Fortunately, we've been finding we can get often unanimous council votes in favor of suddenly charging for parking. Ventura, in Seattle, and a number of other places. And the way you do it is by returning the revenue from the parking meter back to the blocks where it's collected. Now, if you already have meters, you can, for example, split any increase in parking revenue half and half between the city general fund and the local district. But you need to return it back to the neighborhood, the blocks where it's collected, because that way you get the local merchants and business owners and property owners in favor of actually collecting the money. In Pasadena, they have an area called Old Pasadena that is 15 blocks in size. It has 1.3 million in revenue every year from the parking meters in those 15 little blocks. They get enough money from their meters at a buck an hour so that they can completely demolish and completely rebuild all the sidewalks every 2 years if they wanted to. They pay for a huge amount of benefits. Comps, they pay for street sweeping. It has been part of a remarkable turnaround. So step two is to go ahead and return the revenue from the meters back to the place where it's collected. Step three, well, actually, one more thing on that. What if you have a residential area? Like, say, you go to Austin, Texas, and near the university, there's all these students parking their way into the neighborhood. If you do just a residential permit program, then what happens is you throw all the students back out into the campus, and the campus has to build a garage. What Austin, Texas did is they said, let's do a residential parking benefit district. They said, we'll let the college students come into the neighborhood and park, a controlled number of them, and then we'll spend all the money collected from those college students only on public improvements for that neighborhood, you know, traffic calming, utility undergrounding, beautiful architecture, whatever you want. What they found is by doing this, it's like Mark Twain used to say, that we should tax foreigners living in other countries. You know, with a residential parking benefit district, you can tax college students who, they aren't in your district, they don't live there, they don't, you know, otherwise they contribute nothing. You can tax them, you can collect this parking revenue from them, spend it all on your district. You know, if you're in a neighborhood near a downtown, you can do the same thing. And the beauty is that you probably don't care because you're off at work while some college student parks in front of your house. So, commercial parking benefit districts, residential parking benefit districts. Once you've done these first two steps of removing, of charging the right price at the curb and then going ahead and returning the money, you can do step three, which is to remove the minimum parking requirement to all land uses. Because, you know, the point of minimum parking requirements was to create enough free parking at every destination so the curb parking wouldn't fill up. But now you've already found a different way to make sure there's never a curb parking shortage. So you can just remove those minimum requirements. And when you do that, fabulous things happen to architecture and the creation of public spaces. The other thing, of course, is that a lot of good things happen for traffic, for housing costs, and so on. So there's a few more steps. And let me try to go through them pretty briefly. But the last four steps I'll recommend are really sort of extras to help us restore a normal parking market in the United States. One of the first steps that's very useful is to unbundle the cost of parking from the cost of leasing commercial space. So for example, in Bellevue, Washington, they require that you charge for parking if you're a building owner as a separate line item in a lease. So for example, Bellevue, Washington, their rule actually is that the minimum price that the building owner must set is twice the price of the transit pass. That happens to be $144 a month right now, which happens to be slightly less than the actual cost, typically, of building and operating structured parking in Bellevue, Washington. Once you do this, if you are a business owner, you now have the ability to save money whenever you convince an employee not to drive to work. You know, if you give an employee $50 a month cash, if he doesn't park, and you're paying $144 a month for the space, you can pocket $100 a month, and the employee probably thinks he's getting a much better deal, because he is, because he can keep the free parking, or he can choose to drive. So, once you do that, you now have a tremendous incentive for businesses to actually attempt to reduce parking demand. So step five, on the residential side, is to unbundle the cost of parking from the cost of renting an apartment or owning a condominium. If you go to downtown San Francisco, we have an ordinance that says for any residential building with more than 10 units in the downtown area, you must charge separately for the parking. So for example, you go to the Mint condominiums that are being built in an old building, the fee for parking is $300 a month. What they do is that $300 a month goes into the homeowners association, so you have lower dues on the homeowners association fees. The condominiums, of course, sell for less than if they had free parking bundled in with them. So what happens is you have less expensive housing, and you actually have now consumer choice, where if you happen to be one of the 20% of apartment residents who doesn't own a vehicle, you don't have to pay for a parking space. If you're blind, you no longer have to buy a parking space with your condominium. If you're too poor to own a car, you can save $300 a month and maybe, you know, have something like the ability to pay for your drugs if you're an elderly widow. That is your prescription debt. So that step has the benefit of both reducing vehicle ownership, creating less traffic from new developments, and also actually making housing cheaper. In my case, I don't bother owning a car anymore. I belong to City Car Share, and so I can go, you know, reserve a car on the internet, wave this fob out of my keychain, go down and drive around by the hour and get a bill at the end of the month. One of the reasons that's hugely economically viable for me is because I start out by saving $200 a month for a parking space in my neighborhood. So, you know, why own when I can have a car when I need it and not bother with the parking space? Okay, step six is to require parking cash out. Parking cash out is simply the concept that if an employer offers free parking to their employees or subsidized parking, then you require them to give the cash value of that parking space to any of their employees who don't drive, who don't park. Typical example, a series of case studies in Southern California of parking cash out at places mostly that had no transit service. About $165 a month in parking cash out, cash to my drive, resulted in about a 30% decrease in the drive alone rate and parking demand. Now, with a 30% decrease in traffic, you would basically clear up all the major traffic congestion in downtown LA. But also, if you're a developer, you've just saved a huge amount of money on parking demand and therefore parking construction costs. And if you did step four, which was to unbundle the cost of leasing parking from the cost of leasing commercial space, then it's very cheap and easy for an employer to do that. You know, every time somebody doesn't park, he saves the money and he's going to hand it over in cash to the employee. Okay. One last step. Where necessary to attract retail tenants, you probably still have to subsidize parking. So you can, for example, offer 90 minutes free parking in the garages, say, keep setting the price on the street to whatever maintains vacancies. And that way, if you go ahead and do that, you can attract in the retail tenants that you need. Now, it may not be that you really do need the absolutely free parking for short-term shoppers. It may be only perceived, but the reality is, if you're a developer, you gotta try to attract retail tenants. But if you think of it this way, some folks have said, well, you need minimum parking requirements so that you can pay for free parking so that you can attack retailers. But you know, you only need to provide free or subsidized short-term parking, because that way you can attract the you can attract the shoppers without having to provide massive subsidies and massive lots for every employee and every resident. So being selective about who you subsidize in the parking world helps. You put all these seven steps together, and you can really have a transformative effect on the landscape of American cities. Because, again, most of my job, most of my work over the last 15 years has been to basically try to clear out enough space so that those of you who are talented architects and urban designers can make beautiful buildings and beautiful places. And so these steps in parking, they're essentially merely a way of restoring a functioning competitive market to parking, making it as much as possible more like a commodity and less like a Soviet exercise in central planning. When we do that, just by removing the dead hand of government from the lever of planning parking, we are able to actually create massive gains. It's remarkable that you can get a 30% reduction in traffic simply by letting the market work again. So, there's lots more I could say, but I'm going to shut up and listen to others, and also have time for questions.